Hello and welcome to Travels Through Time, the podcast made in partnership with Jordan Lloyd and Colourgraph.
I'm Violet Moller, and today we're going to travel back to one of the most dramatic and tragic moments in English history. 900 years ago this November, a ship carrying the heir to the English throne and his companions was wrecked off the coast of Normandy. The young prince and the flower of the highest nobility were lost under the waves, along with King Henry's dearest hopes and dreams. This dramatic and often overlooked episode in English history is vividly recreated by Charles Spencer in his new book, The White Ship: Conquest, Anarchy, and the Wrecking of Henry I's Dream. He paints a lively picture of the splendour and triumph of the court in the port of Barfleur, celebrating wildly before setting sail on a course of death and destruction. Charles Spencer was a reporter on NBC's Today Show from 1986 until 1995, and he is the author of 7 books, including 2 Sunday Times bestsellers, Blenheim, Battle for Europe, which was shortlisted for History Book of the Year at the National Book Awards, and Killers of the King, The Men Who Dared to Execute Charles I. I spoke to Charles Spencer early last week. So, Charles Spencer, I'd like to welcome you to Travels Through Time. Thank you for coming on. I'm very excited about our conversation today.
Oh, it's a great pleasure. Thank you.
And I think I'd like to start off by asking you, what led you to writing history books in the first place? I know that you've written quite a few now. How did you get to doing that? Was that something you'd always wanted to do?
Well, not really. I mean, I started off after university. I worked for 10 years for one of the American TV networks. And I really did enjoy the writing part of being a correspondent. But then I fell upon the idea of doing a history of my family's house and a history of my family. So they were things I probably had ready to go. And then I thought, actually, I quite enjoy this. And I've sort of stumbled. Each time I've done a book, I've stumbled across it rather than planned it. And so the first one, I'm not going to take you through them all, but the first one.
Please do.
The Battle of Blenheim. And I spotted, this is what I like to find parts of history that have been hugely important, but in my view, sadly forgotten. And so in just before the beginning of 2004, I worked out that we were coming up in that year for the 300th anniversary of the Battle of Blenheim, which was every bit as important as Waterloo, but completely off the charts in terms of history teaching. And so I put that to a publisher, and they said, yeah, they'd take that, but it sounded so monumentally dull that if they bought that book, could they have one on an interesting period? So I said, well, what's that? And they said, well, basically Henry VIII would do very well. Something Stuart's, really. The alternative was the English Civil War. So I did that, and then they sort of led from one to the other, and so that's how I've done it. There's no great structure here. I like a good story.
and so this book that we're going to talk about today, The White Ship, is about a very, very different period of history, much, much earlier, the 12th century. And I wonder how you came upon the idea to write this book.
Well, you know, I hadn't thought about doing a medieval book, and actually when it occurred to me, I was quite nervous because people are very territorial about their period in history. And, you know, it had been bad enough stumbling into the Civil War experts, but the medievalists are even more vicious. And but I was about, it was 5 years ago, I was asked to go and give a speech at Leeds Castle. And it was the invitation came from Alison Weir, who's a very prolific and successful historian.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, who's the audience and what, you know, I literally had a couple of hours to prepare the speech. It had to be on the Queens of England. And I said, okay, I'll do that. And I knew the audience would know an enormous amount about Queen Victoria, Elizabeth, everyone, all the obvious candidates. So I thought I'd throw in a woman who should have been queen, but cruelly wasn't allowed to be at the last minute. And she's called the Empress Matilda. And she only became a candidate for the throne because of the White Ship. So I gave an aside to quite a sort of knowledgeable audience about the White Ship. assuming they'd know about it, and then realized that actually people didn't. It had slightly dropped off the radar. And I suppose I'm of a generation, I'm 56. I'm one of the last who had a very broad compulsory history education. So whereas the White Ship had been taught to me and had gripped me when I was a boy, it had dropped away.
The whole idea that in the medieval period and later, God and religion just imbued every single aspect of life. And I think that's one of the things I struggle with as a historian, is making that mental leap from a, you know, modern society where God is kind of there if you choose to be interested in him, to a society where you literally wouldn't have been able to escape.
It's such a good point, because we just forget it now. I mean, it really is the be-all and end-all, every aspect of life. And so if something terrible happened to you, an accident or a great loss, then it had to be God had decided that you were due that fate. And so the chance is taken out of it. It's all predestined, and it's all pretty terrible, because the God they believed in, the Christian God, was very much an Old Testament one. There was none of the sort of happy feelings of the apostles at all. It was brutal, and it was vengeful, and it was a very mighty person being that was going to strike you down.
And fear played a huge role, didn't it? Your fear of going to hell, or your fear of judgment.
Do you know, it's so interesting, because actually the most captivating figure I found in this book was a man who is counter this entire structure. And he is a very, very powerful Norman born, but with huge territories in England too, baron called Robert de Belem. And Robert didn't believe in God. And it's amazing the freedom that gave him to behave unbelievably badly. And he just didn't care, because he didn't believe in judgment and an afterlife. So imagine if you have that much power and no conscience.
And I wanted to ask you, do you think, because one of the things which I think a lot of people reading this book will be struck by is the brutality and you know, the punishments. I mean, blinding seemed to have been a fairly run-of-the-mill punishment. Do you think that the brutality of society then was in any way connected with what you were saying about their God being this kind of Old Testament terrifying being?
Yes. Yes, it's interesting with blinding and castration and having hands and feet cut off, you know, unbelievable brutality to us. But interestingly, those were considered a lot better than capital punishment. I mean, I don't know what you would choose yourself, but there was a man who was a treasurer to Henry I, who was found guilty of plotting his assassination. And people were amazed at Henry I's great generosity in only having him castrated and blinded. This was thought to be really quite soft. On the other hand, there's a young man, a young Norman nobleman, who was, I'd imagine, lots of fun. And he used to write sort of naughty ditties.
Oh, yes, yes. Yes. What was his name?
He's called Luc de la Barre. And when he's captured by Henry, he for writing, you know, these crude songs about the king, he is sentenced to blinding and castration, and he chooses to kill himself by repeatedly banging his head against the wall of his cell and kills himself. Amazing that he did it, to be honest, because yeah, you'd have to keep going for some time. But so some people, I think that the real thing, it goes back to what we were talking about earlier with God. The Normans got religion in a very big way from the late 11th century. And one of the things the church was trying to teach was the sacred nature of life. And therefore, capital punishment was considered not really doable, except for the most egregious sins. And blinding was seen as obviously a way of completely destroying somebody's life without killing them.
Fascinating. Okay, so if you could just give us a bit of background now and tell us which year you would like to travel back to, that would be great.
Yes, I'd like to travel back to the year of Henry I's greatest sort of pinnacle of happiness and power, which ends in his utter despair. And that is the year 1120, exactly 900 years ago.
Wonderful. And can you just give us some background about Henry I? So he was the youngest son of William the Conqueror. England has just gone through this enormous upheaval of being Normanized and being conquered.
Yes. So Henry I was not meant to get the throne. When William the Conqueror was dying in 1087, he left England to his favourite son, William Rufus, and was persuaded by his barons to leave Normandy to his eldest son, Robert Curthose, who he despised and had been at warfare, civil war between the conqueror and his eldest son for quite some years. And he just left money to Henry as his youngest son. And Henry was very miffed at this. And William apparently comforted him from his deathbed and said, well, one day you'll be greater than both your brothers. And actually that did come to pass, because after the conqueror died, Henry I invested his money in some land in western Normandy and set about sort of busying himself as a younger son who could make something of his life. But his two elder brothers were so much more powerful than him, and they used him and abused him. They sided with him and against him, and eventually took away his territories from him, put him in prison. He really was just a sort of spare part in the succession, really. But then come 1100, he's in the hunting party in the New Forest in early August, when William Rufus gets killed, gets an arrow through his chest, and it kills him instantly. And Henry, rather than look after his brother's body, just leaves him dead in the wood and gallops off at top speed, first to Winchester to secure the royal treasury, and then on to Westminster Abbey to become king. And he's an immensely successful king. He manages to put down what the historical cliche would call the overmighty subjects, you know, these very, very powerful aristocrats who really underestimated Henry. They just saw him as a complete non-entity. They'd not taken notice of his gifts, but he had many. And then he set about making England a place of peace, really. After a year, he had to see off an invasion by his eldest brother, Robert Curthose. But after that very early challenge, he managed to secure the finances of the realm. First of all, by making sure that everyone who had the license to coin his money adhered to his principles of really high purity, so people could be confident in their transactions. And actually, touching on what we said earlier, there were some coiners, some minters of coin who decided to try and play fast and loose with the quality, and they paid for their massive misjudgment by losing their genitals and right hands. And then also he decided to regularize his finances by bringing in an institution that we still live with today, the Exchequer. Before that, the finances in the various parts of England had been expected and would sometimes come in. But now they were demanded, and Henry I had each sheriff come to the Exchequer twice a year and have a full reckoning on a checkerboard. It worked rather like a giant abacus of what was owing and what had been paid. And then the sheriff was sent back with a chunk of wood, because they're basically illiterate, with nicks in the side of it showing what was still owing. And then he spread his power wider still. And in 1106, having had a go for a couple of years at prodding the weak defences of Normandy, where his eldest brother was making a disastrous hand of being the Duke of Normandy, he took on his brother in battle and becomes Duke of Normandy and King of England. And so that unleashes an enormous hostility around what we now consider France. The King of France, Louis VI, known by the nickname of Louis the Fat because of his substantial size, saw the Normans as a sort of pestilence at his side, these descendants of the Vikings who were always causing trouble. But after William the Conqueror had England too, this was an existential crisis, really, for the King of France, because the wealth of England was so considerable, and it meant that the Duke of Normandy was a really powerful figure. And whereas the King of France only actually ruled in an effective way the Île-de-France around Paris, he still could call up alliances with the Angevins in Anjou and the Count of Maine and the Count of Flanders. You know, there were all sorts of satellite areas that he nominally was the feudal lord of. And he managed to pull together various alliances over the next 14 years up to 1120. Basically trying to unhinge the twin realms of England and Normandy. And that was really Henry's battle, because the first one of the first things he did as king was try and establish his dynasty. And he married a princess of Scotland who had a lot of English blood in her to try and attach the old England of Alfred the Great to the Norman conquest. And he produced, this marriage produced a daughter, Matilda, who I briefly mentioned before, the Empress Matilda she became, and then one son, one legitimate son, William the Aethling, or William Aethling, who is, Aethling basically means what we'd consider Prince of Wales today. It means the expected heir. And, you know, this all culminates in this war between 1116 and 1119 between England and the King of France and his allies. And in the summer of 1119, Henry I wins this dramatic battle with several of his sons present. I say several of his sons, having said he only had one son, he had many illegitimate children, 22, we reckon.
Wow.
And they won this extraordinary battle at Bremoul in 1119. And it looked as though everything had come together. You know, Henry had beaten his greatest enemy, brought peace to both his lands, and was delivering up a dynasty to his one true son that was all he had ever hoped to pass on.
Yeah. Well, I think that takes us quite neatly to your first scene. So can you tell us where we are, what's happening, who's there?
I want to take you to Kenilworth in Warwickshire. And we have this brilliant strategy of Henry I to wear down the power of the overmighty barons who are up against him or want to rebel against him. One of Henry's great enemies was the Earl of Warwick, Roger de Beaumont.
And can I just quickly ask, was he a Norman? And were all the barons Norman, or were there any English Anglo-Saxon ones left, or had they been basically all murdered at the...
The Anglo-Saxon aristocracy was basically annihilated after Hastings, but there were some... There were some still going, but the ones who were of great power now were, by 1120, they were pretty much all Anglo-Norman, but they were originally of Norman stock. Okay. So he was a de Beaumont, who was now Earl of Warwick.
Yeah.
And, you know, the last ones who were Anglo-Saxon were up in Northumbria, and they eventually rebelled and suffered as a result. So there are only about seven or eight earls during this period who are active, and de Beaumont is one of them. And he's constantly engineering against the king. So the king has brought in this tactic, really, it's very clever, to, I suppose, what we consider to promote the middle classes, very able members of his administration, to a sort of rank where they could not only compete with the aristocracy, but in some ways sort of leapfrog over them in terms of power. And we have this man, Geoffrey de Clinton, who was a Norman, and he came from Western Normandy. He probably knew Henry when he was just a count of a small part of Western Normandy, when they were young men. And Henry brought an enormous number of these people over with him when he became king. And he gave de Clinton the rank of sheriff of Warwickshire and told him to build a very large castle. This was a message from the king to de Beaumont, Earl of Warwick. He promoted de Clinton to his royal treasurer and chamberlain, taking the place of a man who had had that position before, but who had been found guilty of trying to assassinate him, the man I mentioned earlier who was deprived of parts of him. This was a very strong message to de Beaumont, that this was a man with the king's entire confidence, who was in his patch of Warwickshire, but was just down the road and had the permission. Henry actually gave him the land to build the castle on, and in fact found a priory as well, because these were men of God, as we mentioned. It was a way of establishing in the provinces very direct routes to royal power, because before that, the kings of England had to rely on their earls, really, to be like viceroy and to report back to them and administer justice.
And to be loyal, which was always a problem, wasn't it?
That is so true. How do you know? I mean, Edward the Confessor, the last truly Anglo-Saxon king before Harold, you know, he had endless problems with his earls. They were always rebelling. And in fact, Harold and his family were the worst offenders. So, yes, you couldn't rely on these people were so powerful. You had to hope by rewarding them enough that they would stay loyal to you and do your bidding.
It's interesting though, because this is normally something we associate with the Tudor period and with Henry VII and Henry VIII. I mean, you know, Thomas Cromwell being the ultimate example. But, you know, finding men who are intelligent and promoting them on their own merit, you know, without and then also being able to rely on their loyalty, because they owe everything they have, they owe to you, as opposed to these nobles who are already born into great wealth and power.
Yes. Well, I there's always been, I mean, kings have always promoted people of exceptional ability. But what I think is new is that Henry I brought in what is clearly a system that he was going to do this because he needed people he could rely on. And I think part of it is because he had been a bit of an outlier from royal power as a young man. And he had seen the problems that had been caused to his two brothers in England and in Normandy by having people working against them, people with enormous power. So I think it was a sort of useful apprenticeship to be the third son with who was just jostling along with the others. So he took that experience and made the most of it. The most dramatic example actually was a man called Roger of Salisbury, who was a very simple priest, barely literate, if literate at all to start with, who Henry came across when he was hunting and he had to stop to go to Mass. And he went to a little chapel in Normandy, and he loved how fast the Mass was dealt with by Roger of Salisbury. And being a very busy man who still wanted to do what was right by God, he signed him up as his chaplain, then realized Roger of Salisbury was really good at controlling expenses and keeping an eye on all the details of administration of a at that time, you know, he hadn't got much to spend, but Roger of Salisbury was good at expenditure and budgeting, etc. And you end up with Roger of Salisbury becoming the second most powerful man in the land after the king. And it's a clear, conscious decision to go down the route of merit.
Hello, it's Artemis, one of the presenters on this podcast. You'll know that we've been working with the visual historian Jordan Lloyd and Colourgraph over the last few months to bring moments from our episodes to life. Whether it's shots of the Beatles in 1964 or Oscar Wilde in 1882. Well, these wonderful colourised historical images and many more are available for purchase as museum-grade, archive-quality art prints at colourgraph.co. They make unusual, compelling and just really cool Christmas presents for that history fan in your life. And what's more, a selection of some of the very best prints are now available in a smaller size and for a smaller price. So for just £23 or $30, you can get a fascinating image of the Titanic or Mark Twain, Fidel Castro or Abraham Lincoln. Check out the full range at colourgraph.co. And remember, if you add the code TTT at the checkout, you get an extra 10% off.
Okay, so now we're going to go to your second scene, which requires us to hop over the channel.
Yes, so we're in the same year, of course, 1120, and I want to take you and your listeners to the port of Barfleur, which is sort of east of Cherbourg in the top corner of Normandy. And I'm sure some people will have seen Barfleur. It's one of the most picturesque villages in France, and it looks like a very pretty fishing port. But that you have to jump from that, what you see now, to how it was 900 years ago, where it was the port of northern France for going to England. And it was the stopping off point, particularly to Southampton. That was the big route if you were going to take a journey between England and Normandy. And you have to remember how often that was the case, because whether it was William the Rufus being troublesome in Normandy or Henry trying to hold on to both his realms, they were shuttling backs and forwards on at least an annual basis. Anyway, Henry is coming here at the absolute peak of his triumph, having in the previous summer defeated Louis VI of France, having triumphed again in diplomacy because the King of France appealed to the Pope and the Pope had found that Henry I's cause was just. And then the really big one, Louis VI had acknowledged that Henry's eldest son, William Atheling, was going to be the next Duke of Normandy. So it really was job done. It had taken 3.5 years of fighting to do this. And when Henry arrives in the port of Barfleur, he's followed by the triumphant army, enormous numbers of courtiers and very important men and women of his Anglo-Norman elite. And a man steps forward in the harbour of Barfleur and announces himself to be the son of the man who in his own time had been the captain of William the Conqueror's flagship in 1066. And this man says, surely it's his honour to take the king back in such great triumph to England. Now, I rather like Henry I. I mean, there are bits that are very hard to digest, but he was not one for flattery. He was not one for changing his plans. And he said, no, I already have my ship ready, but tell me about your ship. And the man started to point out all of the joys of his ship, the white ship, the fact that it had a veteran crew of 50 rowers, the size of it, the beauty of it, the speed. And Henry said to him, essentially, well, I'm not prepared to go in that because I'm going in my ship, but it would be fun for my son, William Atheling, and some of my other children, my illegitimate children, my nephew and my niece, and great aristocrats of England and Normandy, bishops, you know, generals, all these people will travel with you. And on the evening of the 25th of November, 1120, almost exactly 900 years ago, Henry sets off for his expected to be 10 or 12 hour journey to Southampton. And he leaves his son and the many hangers-on that this rather glamorous 17-year-old prince has. He leaves them in Barfleur. And do you know, there's an element of over-flattery here. The crew are so excited to have such an eminent young man coming on board for their voyage that they flatter him hopelessly. And in return, he gives them some of the huge quantities of wine that he and his friends are devouring.
Yeah, I like the quotation from the one of the monks who wrote the Chronicles, who reported that too much drinking made them all drunk, which I thought...
Yes, that's science for you.
Yeah, exactly. It'll do that.
No, they got very, very drunk. And people noted, you know, the people of Barfleur had come to look at these people because, of course, they are hugely glamorous. And actually, some of them were coming to say goodbye to loved ones, etc. But a little before midnight, they decided to set off. But crucially, there was this moment where we've already talked about how important religion was. And I'm sorry for those who are very religious, but religion and superstition were very tightly welded together. And you have a tradition for great voyages that ships would be blessed. But when the monks came to bless the white ship, the sort of drunken oafs on board chased them away. And this was later seen as a key moment in what was to be an incredible night.
But that equally, could that not have been added in later by chroniclers as if to say, you know, this is why it happened, because...
I think it's totally, totally possible that that was the case. Yes, I do think that's possible.
And can I ask one more quick question before you carry on? No, November the 25th, it seems like a very late day in the year to be setting off on a voyage, because I thought that, I mean, maybe this is wrong, correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought that seafaring in general kind of stopped in the winter months. Is that not the case?
You're right. It's very, very late. And basically after September was thought to be dicey. Yeah. In fact, that's one of the reasons that the Norman conquest went ahead as it did, because the Anglo-Saxon fleet at the end of September went into hibernation. And that meant that in October, William the Conqueror was able to steal over. So even early to mid-October was considered late. So you're right, this is very, very late. And there was a terror of the sea at this time. And it, actually, in the book, I've pulled together a chapter where you look at the what the sea meant to this medieval mind. And although it was a place of great beauty, they got that, the poets, it was also unbelievably terrifying, because, of course, they knew nothing about what was beneath the waves. Mm. And their imaginations had conjured up all sorts of beasts and, you know, the sirens that would lure you onto the rocks, yes, but sea wolves, sea elephants, sea lions, as in real lions that lived in the sea, even sea goats, which I find rather hard to find frightening, but they did. And then, you know, with the sailors, they were relying very much on experience. They were, the captain of a ship would be expected to know the currents around the harbours that he was trading in. And there was a rudimentary knowledge of the sky, the stars. But really, that was it. And so you can see why they brought God into it, to try and give them some helpful way of getting across this expanse of terror. So anyway, we get to the night of the 25th November, very late, as you say, and it was a freezing night, very calm though, very calm sea. And the white ship starts to set to sea. When the cry goes up, remember everyone's drunk here, the crew and the passengers, that they, even though the king set off several hours earlier, they must try and beat him back to Southampton. And so these 50 veteran oarsmen start to bend their backs. The helmsman is doing a less than brilliant job, and it's not helped by the captain ordering the mainsail to be dropped early. Now, Barflower is an exceptional harbour in terms of being a protected area and a good one for building ships in as well. But along the Norman coast, there are a lot of rocks. So it would not be normal to drop the sail until you're past those rocks. But in the excitement, you know, everyone's going incredibly fast. And then there's this crunch and they hit the rock, the Keyburf Rock, which is still there today, of course. At some pace, and then the panic starts. And of course, something I say, of course, it's not something I realize, nobody can swim. I mean, literally, almost nobody at this time can swim. It's not considered a pastime. And the only people I can find who know how to swim are people who are directly connected with, say, the retrieval of fishing nets or something like that if they're snagged. Yeah. So everyone else is now in a broken ship, which is made even worse by the crew. The drunken crew sort of use their oars to try and push off, and they just make the rupture in the side of the boat worse. And it goes very wrong very quickly, people being drowned straight away. And then I had to look into this actually for this book because I'm not a scientist at all. But you know that feeling you get if you get into...
Yeah, well, I was going to say, even if you could swim, the water must have been so cold, you would have entered shock very, very quickly, wouldn't you?
There you are. It's called cold water shock. It's an actual scientific thing. And it's not just, wow, this is cold. It gives your body a strange reaction and you start to gasp in, and you will gasp in water. So I look... lucky for them in a way, but I think a lot of them died very, very quickly. Mm. And most of them would have been drowned. Others will have had hypothermia. We do know, though, that the Prince William was bundled into a rowing boat. There was one rowing boat on the white ship that we know of, and he was bundled into that by bodyguards and was apparently getting away to the shore, which was only a mile away, when he heard one of his half-sisters, Margaret of Perche, screaming abuse at him for being a coward and rowing away and pleading for her life. And he decides to go back for her, orders his crew to turn around. And that is when people who were drowning saw the little rowing boat and tried to clamber on board and took it down.
Oh, must have been terrifying as they all tried to climb. I mean, it's just the most horrific image you get in your head, isn't it?
That's the image that's always stuck in my mind for the white ship since childhood. That's it for me, is this young boy trying to do the right thing, you know, go and retrieve his sister.
Yeah.
They all drown. That's the most tragic aspect of the story.
Yeah.
I think. But anyway, we know all this because there was one survivor. Well, originally there were two or three survivors. We know the main one who actually does survive all the way. Was called Barreau. And it's a rather wonderful side to this story that possibly the most humble of all the passengers is the only one who makes it through the night. And Barreau the butcher, you know, I've looked into this, and my theory on this is it's because he was wearing the offcuts of his trade. He was wearing sheepskin, goatskin tunic. And actually, even if you're wet, if like he had done, you've managed to clamber out of the sea and he was on a bit of broken mast, Even if that wool is wet, it will still give you some heat. Aristocrats on board were wearing silk and fur, which is no good at all.
But is it also not possible that he wasn't drunk because he was just a butcher? I mean, tell why he was there. I found that fascinating. And actually, I'd like to know, explain why was he on the boat in the first place?
Moreau was there because all these people were disappearing back to England. He thought he may never see them again, and some of them owed him money, and he was determined to have his debts paid. But Moreau is rescued the following morning by three fishermen from Barfleur, and he has this astonishing tale to tell. And that would probably take me to scene three if we want to go there. But
yes, let's carry straight on to scene three.
Well, I think scene three is really just terrible, and it is the king. He gets to the other side, and to Southampton. And Southampton is very busy with other soldiers and courtiers and their wives coming back from the campaign in France. And he decides to go hunting. Now, hunting is the extraordinary passion of William the Conqueror and his children and grandchildren. So many of it's incredible. The casualty rate, by the way, if I'm allowed to spin off for a moment.
And yes, of course. So
it's not just William Rufus. Another one of William the Conqueror's four sons was also killed in the New Forest hunting, Michael Richard of Normandy. And then one of William the Conqueror's grandsons, illegitimate grandsons, is killed the same summer as William Rufus, again hunting in the New Forest. So, you know, this is I think it wasn't just a sport, it was a preparation for war. You know, they really did get it. The firing of arrows, the thundering around on back of horses. I think it was a very, very dramatic thing. And anyway, they loved it. And the New Forest had been settled by William the Conqueror as this huge haven for hunting. Henry's waiting there for his son and the others to catch up with him. And then the news comes across from Normandy, and nobody wants to tell the king. Also, the grief in court is terrible because nearly everybody of importance has lost either a relative or a close friend.
And quite often a child, because a lot of the people on the boat were very young, weren't they? They were sort of the younger generation.
That's exactly right. It was the sort of young and groovy ones who are friends of the prince who were on board. And so they're trying to, or not show, they're crying, actually. And after a couple of days, it comes to this point where one of the king's nephews decides it has to be, that the terrible news has to be given to the king. And he decides he's not going to give it. And he persuades a page boy to transmit the news. And the page boy comes into the king and just blurts it out. And there's this awful moment where the king, Henry I, just bellows in agonized disbelief and then falls to the floor. And, do you know, it's this combination. Of course, he now knows that he's lost not just several of his illegitimate children and, as he's concerned, a nephew and a niece and all these great people on board, but also his one legitimate heir, the one person who he had done everything for. He's been on the throne for 20 years, and it's all basically disappeared overnight on that one voyage. And they say, well, he was carried away in grief, and he went to bed for several days until one of his old retainers came in and told him to stop wailing like a woman, and you know, your enemies would love to see you in this sort of state, and you've got a job to do, and you better get on with it. And one of the things that he told Henry to do was to get married, because Henry was a widower by this stage. Interestingly, all his illegitimate children, and he had some really very, very able illegitimate sons, they were all ineligible, because as I touched upon earlier, you know, the church had got a bit of a grip on the Normans and through them, the English. And so things like illegitimacy really mattered now. And that was quite a change. William the Conqueror had become Duke of Normandy, even though he was illegitimate.
Yeah.
But now that was not an option. And we have Henry I dealing with, you know, paternal grief, but at the same time, dynastic, dire need of producing an heir. So within 2 months, he's produced this this very beautiful bride. She's called the Fair Maiden. Fair Maid of Brabant, Adeliza of Louvain, and he marries her 2 months after the loss of the white ship. And the chroniclers say in a rather coy way that she stayed by the king's side for many months. And then it became years. but no child produced. And of course, they were sort of complete misogynists at this time, so they thought she must be barren.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
She certainly wasn't. In fact, when the king died, she remarried and had six children, so that proves that one wrong. So he's left with this total quandary, and it's astonishing to think that one shipwreck can derail the Norman dynasty, but it essentially did, because Henry then, after several years of not producing any more children, decided that the only way he could move ahead was to convince the barons and bishops of England and Normandy that his one legitimate other child, his daughter Matilda, who had been empress of Central Europe, sort of equivalent to Holy Roman Empress, that she could come back and be his successor. And interestingly, this was thought to be okay. In front of this very powerful and aggressive king, everyone readily agreed to this. But when in 1135 he died, after famously eating a surfeit of lampreys, a very unpleasant water animal, she didn't have a sniff. In fact, the one man who was on the white ship of great note who had got off it.
Yes, but tell us, explain that. Why did he get off it? Because it did seem like there were quite a few people, possibly the more sensible, who disembarked just before it set sail.
Yes, there were half a dozen or so of them. And the most prominent was Stephen of Blois. And there's two accounts. One is that he had a bad attack of diarrhea and didn't want the embarrassment of being, you know, closely confined on a glamorous ship with that going on. And the other one is that he got drunk and was feeling ill and thought he'd just take a later ship. But anyway, it is a sliding doors moment. The king's nephew steps off the white ship. It saves his life. He's one of the sons of William the Conqueror's youngest daughter, Adela of Blois, who's a fantastic woman, I must say, really competent and able and a great inspiration. Much better at ruling Blois than her absolutely hopeless husband who disgraced himself on the Crusades. But Stephen is a sort of old-fashioned, slightly dim, very good at military sort of figure who people like. And he has a very ambitious and able wife called Mathilde of Boulogne. And when he hears that his uncle has died, he races across the channel and is crowned. I think if Stephen had been a decent king, by which I mean strong and intelligent, then he would have. There wouldn't have been a civil war. But after 3 years of him really being very weak and upsetting an enormous number of people, it then suited various people, including King David of Scotland, who was Matilda's uncle, maternal uncle. And her brother, half-brother, who was Robert, Earl of Gloucester, is a fantastic figure, Henry's most able son. And then Roger of Salisbury. These people all thought that a good way of sidelining King Stephen would be to suddenly remember the oaths they'd given to Henry I in loyalty to Matilda. And this caused an unbelievable war. I mean, it's up there with the Wars of the Roses and the English Civil War as a time of utter terror for the average person in England and a bloodshed among the aristocracy. And essentially, it boils down, it's 19 years that King Stephen's reign goes on, and most of it was during a time when the monks said that blood descended on the land.
So it was that long? I had no idea it went on that long.
Yeah, it was really brutal. And it's interesting to see people emigrated from England because it was so lawless. They look back to this with rose-tinted spectacles to the wonderful time when Henry I ruled.
Yeah.
They remembered this time when a young maiden with a purse full of gold could have walked from one end of the kingdom to the other. Well, under Stephen, she'd have been lucky to get out of her door. Unbelievable what they were doing. And you have these little communities, tiny hamlets and villages, which basically became fortified to try and stave off.
Protect themselves.
Yeah, rape and pillage.
And wasn't Matilda quite a force to be reckoned with in her own right?
Oh, I really like Matilda. She was so interesting. So when she had been a young girl and had been the empress, Holy Roman Empress, as it were, she had stood in for her husband when he was off on campaign and had done a really good job as a ruler. The English or the Anglo-Normans had no concept of a queen as in the one we have now, where the queen was the ruler and her husband was a consort. And I think it came down to, and I'm really not apologizing for this, I'm trying to explain it. I think it goes back to the simple business of who would be in charge of an army in battle. And it was just impossible to their mind to see a woman leading them into battle. Matilda was really exceptional. And what I really think shows her quality and her mettle was how she reacted to really tough times. So there was a point in the Civil War where she was absolutely done for. She was holed up in Oxford Castle. She had a garrison that was turning against her. She was surrounded in the winter.
And it was snow, wasn't it? Because that's the bit from my history lesson that I remember the most, was her escaping. There was a picture in the book of the snow and the tower where she was escaping from.
I love that. So she didn't tell anyone apart from her two most trusted knights. And they slipped over the walls of Oxford Castle in the night, dressed in white, as you say, and got through the snow, got eventually to Wallingford, which is always loyal to her. And she could perpetuate the Civil War. There were so many times where she just showed incredible spirit. But on the other side, what was very difficult for the aristocracy at the time was that she was this powerful, independent woman. And when she was about to become queen, she was getting ready in her palace of Westminster to be crowned. The people of London were sort of whipped up into a frenzy of hatred for her because she was considered too haughty, too arrogant. Can't think of a more arrogant trio than William the First, William Rufus, and Henry the First.
But they're men, you know. I mean, that's still happening now. If you're a woman and you are powerful, then, you know, all sorts of accusations are hurled at you. Nothing's changed, I'm afraid.
No, I think that's definitely the case. So we lost a great queen, but interestingly, it was intolerable for people to have this civil war because it was so destructive. Mm. And in 1154, you end up with this situation where a compromise is reached, where Stephen, who's a sort of vain old fellow, really, he just wants to hang on to the trappings of kingship. And they say, yes, you can carry on till you die, but your children can't succeed you. And Matilda's child, her eldest son, Henry Plantagenet, he will be the next king of England. If you look at this whole tale in its entirety, you end up with this situation where one shipwreck, it not only derails all of Henry I's dreams of the future and his dynasty, but it actually is the beginning of the very, very immediate end, actually, of the Norman dynasty altogether.
Yeah.
Because Stephen of Blois' death results in the Plantagenets coming to power, who are the deadly enemy, actually, of the Normans. They're, as the name suggests, they're from Anjou. And they're seen as this sort of wild, terrible family, allegedly descended from the devil, from the devil's daughter. And they had this appalling temper, this record of appalling temper, the Plantagenets, and that was seen to come from the devil. Although it can be quite comical, actually, because we then end up with Henry II as our first Plantagenet king. And I loved, there's one story which I love about him. He was so, he had such a short fuse that one day somebody flattered a great rival of his, the King of Scotland, in front of him. And Henry II decided to chew on his mattress and starts to sort of try and to eat it. And you think that is quite some temper. It would have been a terrifying thing in a king. But at least, I suppose, he was Henry II's grandson, which is, I suppose, a consolation. But it was the end of the Norman dynasty.
Yes, and he was, you know, Matilda's son. So she won in the end, I guess you could say. It's been so interesting talking to you. And I now have to ask you the final question, which is, of course, if you could have picked something up from one of these three scenes and put it in your pocket or brought it back with you to the present, what would it be?
I think it would be the figurehead of the white ship. And also, I'd like the mystery of it, because we don't know what it was like. We know what the figurehead was of the Mora, which is William the Conqueror's flagship. It was of a child pointing forwards. But I just think something that, it's such a monumental moment in our history, the loss of this one ship. Shipwrecks were common, it happened. But to lose the greatest figures of English and Norman society, including the one boy who could have held it all together, I'd like a memento of a part of that ship. And I think that would be the part.
Wonderful. And do you think it's still down, you know, under the sea?
I'm diving there 2 weeks today. I'm going diving off.
You're not? What, in December?
Yeah, I know. I got 2 days reserved in case that one's too rough. But I go, it's with a proper crew of divers.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope so. Otherwise, I think that would be very, very dangerous. That's very brave. Please let us know if you find anything down there. I think that sounds amazing. Very, very brave.
It's 100 years and it's a wooden ship. So all we're hoping to find is maybe some nails or something from it.
Yeah, well, anything. That would be amazing. Thank you so much, Charles. I've really, really, really enjoyed our journey back to 1120 today. It's been a pleasure.
I've really enjoyed it too. Thanks so much.
That was me, Violet Moller, talking to Charles Spencer about his new book. It was published in September by William Collins, to coincide with the 900th anniversary of this devastating event. The White Ship is, of course, available in all good bookshops. And if you'd like some more information and to see some of the beautiful manuscript illuminations depicting Henry I, please visit the episode page on our website, tttpodcast.com. Thanks so much for listening. Until next time.